I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show on BBS Radio with additional material on www.holistichealthshow.com. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. This week, I am focusing on spiritual aspects of holistic health, and I have two excellent guests, each of whom have a new book on the market published last month. My first guest is Dr. Jonathan Ellerby, who has a doctorate in comparative religions and is the spiritual program director of the highly acclaimed Canyon Ranch Health Resort. He traveled throughout the world studying with spiritual teachers from more than 40 cultural traditions. His new book, Return to the Secret Ancient Pathways, The Spiritual Awakening, was released last month and received advanced praise from many of the leaders in spirituality and holistic health. Jonathan is an interfaith minister and leads workshops, retreats, guided travel journeys, and training. He can be reached at jellerby@canyonranch.com or on his website, www.returntothesacred.com. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, and I'm happy to have you here, Jonathan.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
You have a new book called Return to the Sacred Ancient Pathways to Spiritual Awakening, and this will be published in January. Why did you write the book?
That's a great question that I don't get asked enough. I wrote the book for a lot of reasons. Like a lot of people who are authors, I guess there's a part of me that wants to share my messages and work with a larger group of people. But I think the most poignant question really is why this book and why not any other topic that I might have covered? And I think throughout my work and career, whether it's been as a spiritual counselor, whether it's working in the holistic health industry like I do now at the resort Canyon Ranch, or whether it's when I used to be in healthcare where I worked everywhere from the bedside to the corporate office, what I have come to learn and truly believe in is that the most powerful experience of spirituality is one that is based on experience and not philosophy, which means that a person's spirituality is derived from a direct knowing rather than just agreeing to the teachings of another person. So rather than writing a book of my own philosophies and what I've learned, what I've really tried to do is share with people the pathways that have helped a lot of the great spiritual teachers in the world to come to their own direct experience of spiritual awakening. Now, I could add a little. What's interesting for me is that as I've looked at the different pathways that we find in religious traditions and spiritual traditions around the world, I guess at first I expected to see this enormous diversity and that, for example, certain traditions would be colored with certain practices. Meditation, for example, is with Buddhism. Prayer is with Christianity. Movement and yoga is with Hinduism and so on. But in fact, what I found when I actually looked at the vehicles to spiritual growth and personal maturation, I found that the vehicles were in all the traditions. It's just that some traditions focus on some more than others, or they call them different things. But the actual basic means to establish deeper self-awareness and a connection to something greater, they seem to be pretty much recurring throughout time and around the world.
How does the lack of spiritual connectedness relate to physical and social problems such as stress and wars?
Well, maybe to begin, when we talk about physical health, again, looking to my own journey, my own past, my past work, when I work in hospital settings, I noticed that there were certain people who were resilient and always seemed to have a fantastic quality of life and an incredible way to make the most of any situation that they were in. And these could be people who were facing serious injury, illness, disease, amputation, paralysis, and so on, and yet there was something that gave them an advantage, something that left them not only happier in general, but also physically more likely to recover or to have greater odds in their favor. And then there were other people who it almost didn't matter what they were going through, even if it was simple or what some might call routine, they still always seemed to be victims of whatever mm-hmm. they were experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say that the hallmark, at least in my experience, was that those who had that greater resilience and vitality were connected to their spiritual life, their spiritual self. And that didn't always mean a religious tradition, but it absolutely meant that they had a sense of soulfulness.
Mm-hmm.
They had a clear sense of meaning and values, identity. They were at peace with their story of the world and their place in it. And that seems to make all the difference and actually translate into real positive physical outcomes,
mm-hmm.
not just a positive outlook.
Right. Many people feel disconnected from the religion of their childhood, and I'm one of those. What is the relationship between spirituality and religion?
Well, it's a very important question because I think when some people hear me talk, they hear this great emphasis on having a practice and committing to something on a regular basis. And then there comes this question, well, what if my religion doesn't feel right anymore? Or what if I don't have a religious tradition that I'm a part of? So I like to say that a religious tradition is like a home for people's spirituality. It's a way the vehicles, the philosophies, the practices can all be orchestrated, and yet it's not the only way a person can experience their spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
So stepping into a religious tradition, we have certain vehicles of spiritual experience offered. We have certain philosophies and worldviews provided. And that coherent system is what becomes the religion. But still, to make it meaningful and powerful and viable, people need to have a personal sense of spirituality within it. And
mm-hmm.
that's their sense of meaning, identity, connection, and so on. Well, those same qualities can be found outside of a religious tradition. And most of us know people who are deeply peaceful,
mm-hmm.
compassionate, have a strong sense of interconnection with the world and something greater, and yet they may not be religious at all. In fact, some of them might even be atheistic.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I would say spirituality is more about the experiential side, the lived experience of connecting with those transcendent qualities, and religion is really the formalization of those strategies and systems.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Right. Well, I'm one of those people because I don't go to church because I find it too dogmatic, too narrow, and it doesn't meet my needs. But I go to a Search for God group. I meditate. I work with spiritual attributes in my own life. Try to be patient, loving, forgiving, etc. And I believe in a higher being. In fact, it was a higher being that got me through lung cancer 32 years ago when my doctor gave me 6 months to live. So I consider myself very spiritual, but I don't consider myself religious. And I see spirituality as being broader than religion. That religion may be the small, dogmatic rituals and all.
Right. Well, and you know, and I think it needs to be said that in today's day and age, a lot of people are struggling with the role of religion in their families and their communities and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there needs to be a balanced perspective in the sense that, unfortunately, what we see on the news is a lot of the negative consequences, I guess if you want to use the word
right.
negative, the
mm-hmm.
harmful side
right. mm-hmm.
of people who take religion to an extreme. And yet at the same time, you know, we can't forget that many of our great spiritual teachers were in religious traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And many people that are creating healing and change in the world are actively involved in a religious tradition. I think it's about really whether there is a spirituality present as well
mm-hmm.
that makes the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I think you identified that well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. What are the 12 roads to spiritual awakening, and how can people find the path that they are most connected to?
Well, so this is really the centerpiece of the book, Return to the Sacred. And, of course, if it's enough information for a book. It's hard to summarize simply, but let me give you a quick overview. The 12 master paths fall into four categories that essentially acknowledge that every human being has a distinct, unique spiritual personality, which means not everyone is going to be attracted to the same practices. Not everyone's going to find the same practices work for them.
Mm-hmm.
So we find that there are some people that are very physically oriented. They like to do stuff. They're the ones that are, you know, if they can't move while they're doing something, they're probably going to lose interest. So then there's practices for them. Things like sacred movement, things like, which could include yoga, tai chi, walking meditation, things like the use of ritual and ceremony, you know, using symbolism and symbolic behavior to evoke a change in awareness, and also the use of sacred music. And that could be singing, chanting, joining a choir, toning, or using various instruments of sound healing. So those would be the first three in our first category, the physically oriented spiritual practices.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's people that are much more cognitively oriented. They're more into the world of thoughts and ideas. And it's okay for people to come to spirituality through the mind. Meditation is one of the three master paths in this category. The use of the mind to overcome the mind, to focus the mind, to still the mind. Prayer is one of the three in this category. The conscious use of our thoughts, self-talk, affirmations, clear intentions, dialogue with a higher power to create a spiritual growth and connection. And then the third one in the category of what I would call mind-centered practices is sacred study. Truly, deeply immersing oneself in sacred texts and teachings and philosophies in a way that looks for the heart behind the word. Those are the first six, and there's six more. So the other six that we look at in the six master paths, we have three that are oriented around the heart, that are more emotional or feeling oriented. One is the devotional relationship to God. You see pictures of people with shrines and a very loving personal relationship to the divine. We have service, the act of serving others and giving of oneself openly. And then we have working in a devoted relationship with a mentor or spiritual teacher. In the third and, or in the fourth and final category, we have practices that I would call are soul-centered. I would say are soul-centered. By that, I mean that it's really about stripping away a lot of the distractions of life and trying to focus as essentially as possible on this thing we call the human spirit. The first one is working with death and dying. And it may not sound appealing to some, but the conscious process of coming into a healthy relationship with the journey of death and dying, whether it's counseling those who are in the process or whether it's contemplating our own mortality, we find that this is a powerful and universal practice. There is also ascetic practices or practices of renunciation where we give things up. And in the extreme forms, we find people fasting and spending time in isolation. And in the simpler forms, we think of things like Lent, where people give up something of significance to experience themselves without it. And the final of the 12 paths is what I like to call the life path. And it's the path that probably most people say they walk, and yet I'd say is probably the hardest to honestly be on. And that's when life itself is our practice. We take every moment of every day and every relationship as an opportunity to cultivate compassion, connection, forgiveness, and service. So it's a mouthful, but there's your 12 practices and the four different orientations we find in people.
And people will cross over and use a variety of these practices, is that correct?
What I tend to find is that when people are really beginning to delve into their spiritual life or spiritual self, they'll typically pick one in one of these areas as the main one they're focusing on. And then as they grow, absolutely, I would see people as having a primary, probably one or two. And then maybe at least a little something in each of the areas. I actually just completed an audio program with sounds true, mm-hmm. and it's called Your Spiritual Personality, Finding the Path That's Right for You. And we actually spend quite a bit of time talking about what is the spiritual personality, and I would argue that as we mature, while we may have one primary practice of interest, we should probably have at least something in each of the four areas
mm-hmm.
If we're serious about really moving deeply in the spiritual world.
Well, to me, you have to have some in each area in
yeah.
order to survive in the world that we live in today.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I believe. I'm interested, as you know, in health, and I see all of this as an aspect of health. But you also do some work with stress, which to me is a major problem in society today, and also a part of many of the diseases. And you've identified 5 steps to a worry-free life. So I thought it would be interesting to hear what these are.
Oh, well, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, what it brings up for me when people ask about stress and spirituality is that there are 2 respects in which spirituality assists with stress. One is what you might call the relaxation effect, that a lot of our practices are about helping us get out of the mind, slow down, and engage that parasympathetic nervous system that is so healing.
Mm-hmm.
But the other aspect that is so powerful in our spiritual practices is that it's also about giving us new eyes to see our situation and our life, which in many cases diffuses the stress in itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the 5 steps to a stress-free life are really part of that second piece. So the first one is to replace self-talk with prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean by that is be conscious about how you talk to yourself in your mind, and consider that if every thought were a prayer, would we want to send a message to the universe that we hate ourselves, or we doubt ourselves,
mm-hmm.
or we dislike something about ourselves? No, we would want to send a message that says, we are aspiring and we're trying to create change, and we would work with optimism, you know, rather
mm-hmm.
than pessimism or negativity. So it's really about evoking the power of affirmation and positive self-talk
mm-hmm.
through thinking of our thoughts as prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And you certainly interrupt any time if you want to talk about any of these before I go through them all.
Well, that I found very important when I had lung cancer, because I used affirmations, I used prayer, I did visualization, I was on church prayer lists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I went through all of the things that were important, and I think that they all were a part of my healing.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned being positive, not being negative and all. That was another thing. I tried to stay very positive, and to me, that sort of faith, because I knew I was going to get better, and that was my faith. But, you know, people try to put doubt in your mind.
Yeah.
And they don't mean anything negative about it, but it's just their orientation. For example, my mother would say, well, why don't you do what the doctor wants you to do? Why don't you have surgery? Why don't you do chemotherapy? My colleagues, who were all nurses, would say, well, do what the doctor wants you to do, or they would ignore me. They wouldn't talk about it at all. So I think that the faith, being positive, is very important.
Mm-hmm. Great. I love that. I mean, it's so helpful for people to hear examples of what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is to replace noise with stillness.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means for a lot of people is have a time in your day where there are no cell phones, no computers, no television, maybe even no iPod or,
mm-hmm.
or Walkman. Just learn to have a little time on a regular basis with yourself, because it's in that stillness that we not only can connect with peace, intuition, and a sense of guidance, it's also the time where we can find out just how chaotic the mind can be. And so for some, maybe this is a meditation practice, or for others, it's just going for a walk. But again, I would say it's about replacing noise with a period of stillness every day.
Mm-hmm.
you have a whole chapter devoted to the relationship between spirituality and physical health. And how does spiritual practices influence people's health?
Well, I sort of, you know, as I touched briefly on it earlier, I would say that to me there's really just a few primary ways that spirituality impacts people's physical health.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that very often through techniques, it will empower people to engage the healing response of the body.
Mm-hmm.
This was something Herbert Benson really popularized,
mm-hmm, right,
many
uh-huh
physicians have written about, and some call it the relaxation response. This is the engagement of the parasympathetic nervous system and the diminishment of the stress response. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, any condition is going to be challenged by the experience of stress or people being agitated or aggravated, and any condition will be enhanced
mm-hmm
by people being able to engage that natural physiological mechanism. So spiritual practices that engage the relaxation response is absolutely one dimension. The next dimension then that we have is around coping and clarity, which means that if a person has a spiritual perspective on life, usually that means they have a worldview that helps them to make sense of what they're experiencing so that they can learn from it in a way that's empowering
mm-hmm
and have a clear kind of mindset that helps them to make effective decisions.
Mm-hmm.
One of the places where people get stuck when they're unwell is they give away their power. They give away their sense of choice. They give away their sense of clarity. They become confused and overwhelmed. A healthy spiritual practice can help to manage this or transform this. And the third and perhaps most fascinating quality that spirituality can lend to a healing journey is all the healing mechanisms that we are yet just beginning to understand. Things like the power of visualization,
mm-hmm,
things like the power of belief, mind over matter,
mm-hmm,
things like the power of prayer and energy healing and spontaneous remission and the seeming intervention of other forces. And this is on the edge of medicine, and yet many, many physicians and public health specialists today are realizing we can't ignore the impact of mm-hmm these dimensions of spirituality and health, because they do make a difference. We
right
do have case after case after case of what they would call nothing more than placebo
mm-hmm
transforming a condition, and sometimes conditions as serious as tumors or chronic conditions. And yet, if belief, if energy, if ceremony, if spiritual practice can evoke that vital force
mm-hmm
and support that kind of change, well, then we absolutely need to not only investigate it, but continue to use it.
Right, right. Enlightenment and mystical experiences. I have people tell me that they have mystical experiences. But is this really possible today, or is this just wishful thinking?
Yeah, I really do believe it's still possible. And I think that it seems more challenging today because the essential obstacles to mystical awakening really evolve around our attachment to what I would call dualistic thinking, or what a lot of people would call dualistic thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being preoccupied with judgment and blame and pictures of victim and good and bad and right and wrong. And even though those terms may play a functional role for a lot of us, the more caught up we become in that sort of dualistic thinking, the easier it is to become frustrated,
mm-hmm,
attached,
mm-hmm,
the easier it is to have expectations and so on. And what we find in the accounts of the great mystics throughout time is that this spiritual experience is at its heart the opposite of those things. So yeah, I absolutely agree. If
there's
cynicism or doubt that we can still have spiritual experiences or a mystical awakening, I get where that comes from. But I absolutely think it's still possible. And I think people are having those experiences
mm-hmm
in moments all the time,
mm-hmm,
except I don't think they always know how to cultivate them or identify them, because they shrug it off as just sort of one of those things or kind of a strange moment, or they don't have a way to make sense of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Jonathan, is there anything else you'd like to tell the listeners?
Well, I think given the opportunity and how strongly you and I both feel spirituality relates to health,
mm-hmm.
I would say that there is no better time to start exploring your spiritual life than the present. One of the biggest obstacles I see in my clients is people have had a story about what spirituality is that didn't work for them, and as a result, they disconnected from it altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But spirituality is innately personal. So find out what your spirituality is all about. Find out what your deepest sense of meaning is. Ask yourself, if you had a limited time left on this planet, what would it mean to live it in the most fulfilling way,
mm-hmm.
in the most empowering way, so that you not only could cultivate your greatest joy and expression of your gifts, but you could also make a difference before you left.
Wow.
And I think if people start to ask those kinds of questions, they see that spirituality is a part of everyone's life, and it's really a matter of choice, and it's a matter of experience, and the only thing we can do is begin and let life give us the feedback we need to continue.
And I'm wondering if we're not going to have more of that in over the next 4 years. And I'm thinking in terms of 2012, when
yeah.
the Mayan calendar ends, and people see that as the end. Well, I see it as the end of the world as we now see it,
yeah.
but as a period of enlightenment. And to me, we needed the last 8 years so that it could help people turn in a different direction and see what is really important in my life. And now there's 4 years for those people who have turned and looked at what is important in my life. Is it money, power, greed? Is it being of service to others, helping others? And we have 4 years now to work toward 2012, which to me is the period of enlightenment.
I absolutely agree. You know, the last chapter and afterward of the book, Return to the Sacred, really echoes this message exactly. And
yeah.
even though people may pick it up because they want to manage stress and find health,
mm-hmm.
there's this greater calling waiting for us that you just named. And it's realizing that when we access our deepest potential,
mm-hmm.
we are actually doing something that is not self-centered and narcissistic. It's really awakening something that is for the healing of the world. And I believe we're coming to the end of a very difficult cycle for this planet. And the sooner people get clear about their path and the tools that will help keep them stable and opening
mm-hmm.
through these difficult times, they will become leaders and helpers and healers as we turn the corner and move towards an era of healing
mm-hmm.
and light.
Right. Won't that be great?
Yeah, I'm excited. We just need to be patient and, you know, have a bit of humor with some of these hard times, because just because we have this hope doesn't mean that it isn't also difficult. And I
right.
think people need to hear that spirituality doesn't make things better overnight, that true spirituality is a growing process. And anyone who promises you that they can take away all your pain in a moment and give you all the answers is probably someone who doesn't have your best interest at stake, because that's not exactly how the healing process works. But we can support each other, and we can journey together, and we can start creating a better life and a better world right now. I don't think we need to wait for someone else to do it for us.
But I do think spirituality makes it easier, because there's a lot of fear and doubt and all of the negative things in the world. But if you have the faith and patience and the other things that come with spirituality, you don't get caught up in all of that negativity. And so it makes living much more joyful and much easier.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Jonathan, could you tell us how we could obtain your new book when it's published, and any other products and services that you have?
Yeah, of course, I would be happy to. Well, the easiest way to get the book between, or to purchase the book between now and January 1st, is to go to Amazon.com, where they have a fantastic sale price, a pre-sale price, they call it, meaning you can buy the book for a very discounted price, and then when it's released January 1st, they'll send it to you. If you need details, you can go to my website, which is returntothesacred.com. That's return to the sacred, one word, written as one word, returntothesacred.com. And then you can also find out updates about where I'm going to be speaking and workshops and things like that. I also have a audio program with Sounds True coming out in February. And, of course, the book, Return to the Sacred, Ancient Pathways to Spiritual Awakening, will be on bookshelves in your bookstores January 1st.
And do you do consultation?
I do a limited number of one-on-one consultations because my primary practice is on the property of the Canyon Ranch Health Resort.
Mm-hmm.
So I do private consultations with our guests, and I have an administrative function as the director of spiritual programs. So I don't always have a lot of extra time for that,
mm-hmm.
but I absolutely do speaking engagements, workshops, and then work with people more privately in those kinds of settings. So,
and this would be the same website that people could reach you?
That's it.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate this very much, Jonathan. It's been very interesting, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. It's been really nice talking with you.
And I look forward to having you again.
Great. Well, I look forward to it too as well.
Thank you.
Great.
My second guest is Dr. John Robinson, who has a doctorate in psychology and worked many years in this field before retiring in 2001. In 2006, he received a doctorate in divinity and has written numerous articles and books and given many presentations. He will talk about his latest book, Finding Heaven Here, and he will tell us how we can experience heaven on earth. He can be reached at www.johnrobinson.org. I welcome you, John, to the Holistic Health Show, and I look forward to an interesting discussion on heaven on earth.
Well, thank you, Carl. It's great to be here. I think this is going to be fun.
Thank you, John. First, I would like you to tell us who you are.
Well, I am a combination of things, and it's important to review them because my message is so seemingly far out that I want listeners to understand that I'm not just a crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a psychologist, ordained interfaith minister, teacher, author, and mystic, though not necessarily in that order. I have doctorates in psychology and ministry, 4 published books, and I've really taught mental health professionals and spirituality classes for years. So I'm really grounded in this area and really have spent probably the last 20 years trying to distinguish between what really is psychological and what is spiritual and how do you balance the two.
Mm-hmm. And what is heaven on earth to you?
Heaven on earth is really the ordinary world, the one we live in every day, but it is transformed and transfigured by a shift in consciousness. So instead of becoming what looks like the ordinary world, which we see through all of our intellectual filters, it is, in fact, the divine world. It is God as the world itself.
Mm-hmm.
And when we learn to experience God's presence, the mystics tell us throughout the world that everything is transfigured into an incredibly beautiful, holy, peaceful place all around us, a place that I can see every day.
Mm-hmm. Don't we really create our world with
our
minds?
Yeah, you know, that's what the Buddha said. He said, you know, we are what we think. All of our worlds are created by the kinds of thoughts we have. And the problem is that most of our thoughts are rather negative and organized around scary themes of scarcity and violence and danger. So we create a world that's very damaging and scary instead of seeing the
mm-hmm.
world as it really is beyond
mm-hmm.
the filters of thought. And that's a pristine and incredibly special place.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't our current leaders try to create our world by bringing about fear-mongering and things like that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, I've been worried about that for some time now. We need to help people see the way things really are. If we fill their consciousness with threat and danger
mm-hmm.
and scarcity and,
mm-hmm.
and fear of terrorists and others, then what happens is that we begin to be the dog chasing its tail. We start seeing it everywhere. And
right.
then we start acting on those misperceptions, those misguided ideas, and we create the very hell that we don't want to have here on earth.
Right. Well, I've always felt that if people had more faith, that they would not fall into the trap of believing all of the fear mongering.
Yes. A famous, well-known Hindu sage of the last century said, you know, that the truest form of prayer is to stay in the awakened state without thought,
mm-hmm.
meaning that we stay very present to what is, but we don't even cloud our mind with the thoughts about this or that or you or me or what is. Instead, we just stay present to what is, and that is, in effect, staying present to the divine.
Right. Yeah. That's great. And why did you write the book on Heaven on Earth, John?
Well, you know, I wrote this book because seeing heaven on earth changes you, and I think it can change the world. When people see where they really are, hatred, violence, selfishness, all the politics of divisiveness will
mm-hmm.
end.
Mm-hmm.
I'd seen heaven on earth ever since I was a child, you know, but I didn't need words for it. It was
mm-hmm.
just the natural world seen without the lenses of the mind. But then when I grew up and kind of got enculturated in with school and peers and adults and so forth, I really lost touch with it. I thought, there must be something wrong with me. But then when I began to look at the world's religious literature through all the traditions,
mm-hmm.
I discovered that all the mystics, all the sages in every religion speak of heaven on earth. They may use different words like the pure land or the Garden of Sheba or the Kingdom of God, but it's the same place.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I was reading one man's particularly vivid mystical experience, and I suddenly got it. The mystical experience, this moment, you know, when the veils lift and you see how incredibly beautiful the world is and you feel surrounded by a presence and so
mm-hmm.
forth, that's actually a description of what I saw as a child and what heaven on earth really is. It was kind of a discovery that the mystical experience was a description of heaven on earth and our truest perception of ultimate reality. It's
mm-hmm.
like I thought, how come people don't know this? This is really important.
Right. I wonder if this may be the same thing as people in the health area talked about as peak wellness.
Yeah, I think it is. I think, or what Maslow talked about as a peak experience.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you're so in touch and your awareness is so heightened by being in your body, by being alive, that you begin to shift into this higher realm of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the people that talked about it that I'm aware of, like Helbert Dunn, who wrote much on wellness, and
uh-huh.
Rene DeBose, were people that, as they got older, spirituality became a very important part of their life. And so I agree that probably this had something to do with their seeing heaven on earth.
I think you're right. I mean, I think it's been my feeling, and particularly as I'm getting older, too, that aging is about waking up.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the identity, time, and story, all these fictions we have about ourselves begin to run out when we realize time is running out.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
if this is all we have, we start experiencing it more intensely with more awareness and sensitivity, and then bingo, there it is.
Mm-hmm. And, John, if heaven on earth exists, why don't most people see it?
Well, the thing is that most people actually do see it, but then they quickly turn away and discount it as something else. I mean, I think everybody can remember times in their life when suddenly everything was beautiful. It might have been when they were in love. It might have been when
mm-hmm.
they, with the birth of their first child, perhaps after a brush with death or serious depression, when they were coming back to the world and suddenly aware of its immense beauty, or in the midst of any natural beauty, like when you're standing at the base of Yosemite Falls and you hear the roar, you can't
mm-hmm.
be thinking about your bank account or your stock investments going down. You just stand there in radical awe at the immense beauty and power of the world. That is a moment of heaven on earth. But then, of course, we say, well, I was just, you know, in Yosemite, or that was just I had just fallen in love or something. That's all it was. And that's the mistake, because
mm-hmm.
we need to remember that that was actually an opening, a glimpse to the divine world.
Mm-hmm. I'd take it back a step further and say, if people paid attention to their dreams, they
yeah.
developed their faith and all of these things, they wouldn't have invested in the stock market in the
yeah.
first place, and so they wouldn't
exactly.
have to worry about that.
Yeah,
because I think God directs us in a way, if we listen, that saves us from a lot of these hassles of life.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
our faith takes us through the rest of it.
I really came to appreciate the difference between heaven on earth, or the divine world, and the world of man that we superimpose on it with all its belief systems and its ambitions and self-centeredness and so forth. And it's really clear that when you learn how to stop thinking and heighten awareness and just experience the divine world as it is, you lose interest in that investment portfolio. You realize that it's such a false and empty process.
Mm-hmm.
And when you stand immersed in the sacredness of being, you say, oh, my God, I'm home. I don't need that stuff.
I'm wondering if some of this, too, is what Eckhart Tolle is trying to get people to do, and that is to overcome ego.
Yes.
And overcoming ego would seem to bring you closer to a spiritual awakening that might then bring you closer to heaven on earth. Is that right?
I think that's exactly what he's saying. I mean, he told us that a new heaven is the emergence of a transformed state of human consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Of course, other people have talked about that, too. Richard Buck, you know, the fellow who wrote Cosmic Consciousness
mm-hmm.
over 100
mm-hmm.
years ago, basically said, you know, when you have this experience, suddenly you're lifted out of your old self and the old world, and the earth becomes heaven,
mm-hmm.
literally,
when you
begin to wake up at this level.
Mm-hmm. John, how do we learn to see heaven on earth?
Opening the perceptual gates to heaven on earth is possible, and it's something I talk a lot about in my book.
Mm-hmm.
And the skills for coming into the presence are twofold. One is to remember times when you were there before.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was saying people really need to remember that those moments of falling in love were actually moments of heightened awareness, glimpses of the divine world. But there are also practices that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
One of them that I include is called finding the keys to the garden, and the keys include these four steps. Stop thinking, very important, because it's our thoughts that filter our experience and immediately return us to the world of man, to the scary world.
Mm-hmm.
So, and stopping thinking is actually much easier than we think. You know, by shifting into a sensory awareness, as if alarm bell had just rung someplace nearby, you know, you suddenly shift from a mind cluttered with beliefs and worries to a sharpened sensory perception. That's the first step.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next step is to heighten this awareness, to intensify perception in the present and be as awake as you can. You know, like knowing there's a lion outside the door, you really heighten awareness and tune in. And then the third step is to experience the world exactly as it is, with sharpened senses, as if you'd never seen it so clearly before. That experience tunes you into God because as you awaken this way, you discover that one of the two states of God that God takes on is the world itself. As you look into the texture and the beauty and the nature of things right before you, you'll begin to realize that they are divine, that
mm-hmm.
everything in them shines with the divine. And then the next step is to come into God's presence, and there's lots of ways of doing this, and most people really know how to do it already. They may not practice it often, but in the coming into the presence of the divine, the experienced presence, all these things come together, and then you say, my God, this is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I am so glad to be here. This is so extraordinary. You know, you want to just drop to your knees and say thank you
mm-hmm.
to know where you really live and where you really are. And then everything from that point becomes much more of a flow, the flow of mystery, the flow of being that you live in and from which love just comes naturally.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that meditation helps in that process?
Oh, absolutely. I think meditating is a way that we learn to disconnect consciousness from our thought processes. We can begin to watch them and let go of them rather than jump on them like a horse, saddle them up and ride them off into the sunset,
mm-hmm.
which only causes us more distress.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what is heaven on earth like?
Heaven on earth, when you learn to shift gears, as I was describing, is a breathtakingly beautiful place filled with astonishing colors, rich textures, constantly shifting perceptions. The world actually seems brighter, clearer, more lovely, more hyper-real and fascinating than you could ever think about. It's much different than anything you think. And it's like looking at the world as a stained glass window. Light seems to shine through everything, even people. You know, people are often seem to me like angels who don't know they're angels.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, oh, my God, how beautiful you are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an enchanting, holy, timeless, and serene place that's filled with a conscious and loving presence, not the imagination of a presence, but an intense awareness that everything is alive, that the whole universe is saturated with this intelligence that knows you and loves everything and is everything, so that everything you have relationship with is part of this love relationship with the divine. And here, in this state of consciousness, there's no ugliness, there's no corruption, everything pulsates with divinity. Which I find even more interesting is that problems, all the problems that you think you have,
mm-hmm.
begin to dissolve and evaporate in this consciousness, and you discover that the problems were thought forms superimposed on this beauty of being. And when you shift to the beauty, the problems just disappear like smoke up a chimney.
Mm-hmm.
We discover in the end that heaven never left. We were never kicked out of the garden. We left of our own accord by being too enchanted by the world of thought and ambition and ego and self.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always been here waiting for us to come home.
Isn't it interesting, John, that when we lose someone through death or divorce or whatever, that things that seemed important no longer seem
that
important.
That is so profound. Yes. They realize we just got so addicted and strung out on the beady world of man with all of its gadgets and things and
mm-hmm.
forget what's important.
Right, right. Can you help us, John, experience heaven on earth right now?
I think you can experience heaven on earth anytime, and I would encourage you to follow the same four essential steps. If your listeners can take a moment to stop thinking,
mm-hmm.
give themselves 5 or 10 minutes so that they're not going to be interrupted, and then do that shift. Suddenly let yourself move from your thinking mind to your perceiving mind, move from conception to perception. So you look around the room and you say, oh, this is where I really am. Notice the things in the room, and then heighten your awareness so that you can look at something even more intensely, like you look at the skin on your hand or the fabric or the weave of your shirt or the wood in your desk, but you look at it incredibly intensely and you say, wow, I didn't realize that was like it is. I didn't realize how amazing that was. And then you move into experiencing the entire world like that, one thing at a time, with sharpened senses, because now you are moving into the divine world. One thing that's also useful is at this moment, then to silently whisper God or whatever your name for the sacred is, to tune in ever more deeply and sensitively to the world as the divine being. Say, oh, God, you are here. This is you. And then in this movement, move even further. Come into the presence. The presence is around you right now. It's always around you. See if you can feel God's consciousness in this room, surrounding you, aware of you, touching you like soft sunlight on your skin. Feel the joy of this renewed reunion with the divine, and feel the bliss of being shrouded in such a safe and holy space. And then as you look around you, notice that there is no clutter. Things that may have seemed like clutter are actually just laying exactly the way they should be laying.
Mm-hmm.
And the sounds are exactly the way they should be, and everything is so amazingly beautiful, and you are home.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't start thinking about this. You start thinking, oh, this can't be heaven. Then you go right back into your thought world, and you lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you do, you repeat the key. Stop thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Heighten awareness. Intensify awareness and perception in the present moment. Experience the world exactly the way it is and come into God's presence. Then there it is again. And this becomes a practice that we can use any time on the bus, walking down the street. And I've taught classes for years on this topic and this technique. And people would be amazed taking walks that they were seeing places that they had walked in over and over again but never seen before. And suddenly, my God, they were beautiful. They
mm-hmm.
would stand rapt in front of a tree or listening to a bird or watching a child play in a schoolyard and notice that, and when they looked at their watch, the 30 minutes had passed.
Mm-hmm.
They were so transfixed by the beauty of the universe.
So your students have experienced this.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that's what this book is all about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the only one. There are hundreds and countless people who have experienced this shift from the ordinary world to the divine world, which is why I also collected over 100 references and quotations from the great teachers of the world, because I wanted people to know this was not just my own nutty idea, that everyone from Jesus, and let me give you some quotes from the great mystics, because these people
mm-hmm.
are saying the same things, we just haven't been listening. Jesus said, "The Father's kingdom is spread out upon the earth, and people do not see it. What you look for has come, but you do not know it." And the famous Hindu sage Ramana Maharshi said, "This is the kingdom of heaven. The realized being sees this as the kingdom of heaven, whereas others see it as this world." And you all know beloved Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, who says, "You don't have to die in order to enter the kingdom of God. It's better to do it now when you're fully alive. The kingdom doesn't have to come, and you do not have to go to it. It is already here. There is not one day, he confesses, that I do not walk in the kingdom of God. And I can go on with quotes mm-hmm. like this. I've got over 100 of them from all the world's religions. And I thought to myself, wow, this is the best kept secret on the spiritual path. How come we don't talk about this?
Right.
So I am.
Mm-hmm. John, what do you think of some of the music that affects the alpha theta waves, such as Tom Kenyon's music? I use that sometimes when I meditate, and I go into an altered state, and I wake up maybe an hour later.
Wow.
And the whole hour has gone by. And I don't know where I've been, but I seem to be fairly alert when I come to again.
Do you notice that your perception has changed when you come out of that state, when you re-enter the world?
Yes.
Yeah, right. I think that's exactly the same. There's lots of ways to break the spell of the ordinary world, of the conceptual world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even, you know that woman, what is her name, the one who had that very profound, my stroke of insight, I know her name will come to me in a minute. She had this, she was a neuroscientist, her name is Jill Bolt Taylor. So in her 30s, sometimes she's getting up, getting ready for work, and she starts having a left hemisphere stroke, a stroke in her left cerebral hemisphere, and she watches all the lights go out, basically, in her mind, all the programs go offline.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, she begins to experience this incredible sense of grace and bliss and this sort of oceanic consciousness, and she realizes she's also having a mystical experience.
Oh.
You know, so there's lots of ways that we can, don't have to have a stroke to turn off the left hemisphere, but the left hemisphere is really that thinking, conceiving part that always makes everything into a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that becomes quiet, and meditation is one of the ways we quiet it, then we begin to use the right hemisphere, which is this heightened awareness of what is without thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke with Jill Taylor because I was so intrigued by her experience, and she said very clearly to me, the right hemisphere is heaven.
I guess she knows, right?
She's been there, yeah.
Yep. John, how would you respond to someone that says, how can there be heaven on earth when there's so much suffering and evil around?
You know, that really is such an important question. It's one of the greatest obstacles, I think, to finding heaven here, because our beliefs about pain and suffering, we use these beliefs always to prove to ourselves that it's not possible, and having proven to ourselves it's not possible, we slam the book shut and we go back to the world that we live in. In other words, we turn away from the possibility of experiencing the divine world and go back to the world of suffering, and it's a great tragedy. Just because people do terrible things does not mean heaven's not here. It just means they are tragically blind to it and live instead in their emotional hell world. And we need to keep in mind that the moment we argue, saying, oh, it can't be, look at the suffering in the Biafra, look at the war in Israel and so forth, as soon as we make that point, we have painted ourselves into a corner and bought into the stories that the government has been wanting us to believe, that
right.
everything's dangerous and everybody's an enemy,
right.
and we lose it again.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The terrible things we do to each other come from these belief systems, not from our true nature.
Right.
And when we live from our true nature, everything is so much more peaceful and loving. Chris McCombs has a wonderful short poem that goes something like, it's actually a riddle. He says, what's the difference between a student and a sage?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, the sage dwells in the stillness of his original experience.
Mm-hmm.
The student still thinks there's something to think about.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the time we're so caught in our thoughts we don't see where we are, and we leave the peace beyond all words that lives around us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible to live there now.
John, are your students primarily people who are interested in this to begin with?
I think they're people who are interested in ecumenical spirituality or interfaith spirituality. They want to learn about spirituality from all traditions. They probably have learned as much or gotten a heavy dose from their own tradition growing up, but they want to know, okay, so what does Buddhism say about this? What does Hinduism say? What does, each of these traditions, what do they offer me that I haven't already understood? And from this place, they begin to get in touch with the mystical tradition, which is in every religion, and the mystics lead directly to direct experiences of the divine.
Mm-hmm. John, can you tell the audience about your products and services and how they can reach you?
Sure. Probably the easiest way to learn about me is to go to my website, www.johnrobinson.com. it lists all my books. I've written 4 books. My current book is Finding Heaven Here, which is about the actual experience of heaven on earth and how desperately the world needs that experience. And much of what we've been talking about today comes from that
mm-hmm.
book.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been great having you on the show, John. It's been very informative for me, and I'm sure for the listeners, and I hope we'll have contact again.
Carl, thank you so much. I really appreciate the conversation, too.
Uh-huh.